Welcome to the Composer Studio Podcast. On the Composer Studio, we listen to the music of living composers. We talk to them about their writing process, and we learn about the world of music that they live and work in.
I'm Anna Linville.
And I'm Tarek Ghirardella. Recently deemed one of new music's leading names, one of the top 35 female composers in classical music, and a rising star on the American compositional scene, composer Sarah Kirkland Snyder writes music of direct expression and dramatic narrative that the New York Times has called rapturous, and NPR has referred to as ravishingly beautiful. Her music can sound ageless and contemporary all at the same time, with an emotional impact that is direct and immediate. Snyder's work has been performed by so many orchestras around the world: the New York Philharmonic, the Boston Symphony Orchestra, the Cleveland Orchestra, the Birmingham Royal Ballet, soprano Renee Fleming, and the Emerson String Quartet, just to name a few. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Sarah, we have tried for a while to get you on the show, and finally, the schedules aligned, and we were able to do it. Want to thank you so much for being part of the show tonight.
Yeah, I'm flattered to be here and delighted that you asked. And again, I'm sorry that this fell through the cracks a year ago or whatever it was, but I'm glad we're here now.
I'm glad we're here now too. Yeah, thank you so much for being a part of the show too. It's awesome.
Of course, yeah. So it's been around for a while, huh?
We've been around for just before COVID we started. Oh, wow. And then we had to quickly figure out how to reinvent the show when COVID happened. And then we discovered, wow, we really like this format, doing it this way. We were trying to do it live most of the time.
Oh, wow.
And stick locally.
Oh, wow.
And then occasionally maybe bring in a guest by phone who maybe wasn't local.
Okay. Yeah.
And then when COVID hit, we suddenly realized, well, hey, right now we can reach out to composers all over the world if we wanted to.
Yeah.
And it just launched from there.
That's so cool. So, you're a composer and a drummer, is that right?
I am, yeah.
Very cool. And Anna, I saw Tariq's bio, but I didn't see yours. Are you you're a composer as well?
No, I'm actually a singer.
Oh, cool.
And an author. So I write about international relations, and I've done a lot of diplomatic outreach, cultural outreach, so mainly focused on music and theater. So I'm interested in music from the social society side.
Okay, yeah. How did you guys find each other?
Great question. We met at a party.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Couple of glasses of wine or beers into it, and then we were just yapping and yapping about classical music, and then, you know, interrupting each other's sentences. I mean, it was just like a frenzy.
Uh-huh.
And and then, you know, then some of our friends like Joey and Amy, they would chime in and kind of help nudge the conversation along. Uh-huh. And then we realized, you know, I brought up the idea for a composer studio show that had been mulling in my head for so long, and she loved the idea.
Wow.
And she had all this experience that she just described to you.
Yeah.
With outreach. And she knew all of the inroads and the logistics of getting something like this together and getting the ball rolling.
That is awesome. Because you really need that. You need both sides for something like this to work. It's like one thing to have the artistic vision, but it's another one to make all the logistical, practical stuff mm-hmm. happen. And it's different skill set. So that's great that you guys found each other. That's awesome.
And Anna's super creative too. She is. And even in interviews, she always asks the greatest questions. I've always been like in awe of her ability to listen so well.
No pressure.
No, that is awesome. That's really great. It sounds like you guys are a great twosome. And
yeah, fantastic. It's fantastic.
Very cool.
So let's talk about you, Sarah. Let's talk about, what makes you the composer that you are today? There's a lot about you online. Obviously, there's a lot of interviews that I've watched, podcasts like you spoke about, ones that you've recorded in the past. But I wanted to ask you, you know, why composition? What led you to want to be a composer in the first place?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think music was my first great love. I mean, music was something that fascinated me like nothing else in the world from, you know, my earliest memories. Like, I was the very dorky musical kid who would show up at show and tell in nursery school and just sing wordless vocalese. Like, I wasn't a particularly good singer, but I just had all these musical ideas that I wanted to share with people. And I think I was always so struck by how much music moved me, and I wanted to share that experience with other people. So I would show up early. I would have my parents take me to school early in the mornings. My mother really kindly obliged this, but I wanted to be playing the piano whenever other kids were coming into the classroom so that I could share music with them. And I would just improvise stuff. And, you know, I wanted them to feel what I felt when I was listening or experiencing music. I just thought it was this amazing, magical force that brought us together and had the potential to make us feel the same thing. And I just thought that was such a remarkable thing for different humans to know, like, we feel like we were living in the same mindset or something. And so for me, that was, I don't know, I just always loved music. And as I got older, that desire to share it grew stronger. But, you know, being a professional composer was something that I fought really hard for a long time. And I was late to the profession. So I think that was mostly out of fear.
So what is your primary instrument, or do you have a primary instrument?
Yeah, piano is my primary instrument. And I started that when I was like 6 or 7. We didn't have any instruments. I should say I came from a non-musical parentage, and we didn't have any instruments at home. So I would go around the neighborhood and knock on neighbors' doors and ask if I could play their piano. And I had some very nice neighbors who would let me play their piano. And then finally, my parents talked my grandparents into sending up their piano from North Carolina. So I grew up in New Jersey. So eventually we got a piano. I started piano lessons. And then I also started to play the cello when I was 10. And started doing a lot of choral singing and that kind of thing, and chamber music, summer camps. You know, I played in string quartets and stuff like that from a young age, just informal summer camp and music programs, things like that. But piano sort of remained my primary instrument.
Is there or are there composers that you regard as the ones who inspired you to write your first piece, or the ones you tried to emulate when you wrote your first piece?
Yeah. My piano teacher started me with Scarlatti and Mozart and, you know, a lot of that stuff that kids play when they're young. But Mozart really, I really took to Mozart and as so many kids do. And I fell deeply in love with his music. And then as I got a little bit older, I got into, in middle school, I got into Debussy and Ravel and Chopin, and I really fell in love with their music. I would say I spent the most time in high school trying to emulate Debussy and Chopin of all the composers that I played. Yeah. So I have a lot of music that's like somewhere between Debussy and early Joni Mitchell. Or like early Debussy and Joni Mitchell.
That's a nice combination.
She had like some really interesting, she has some very interesting, you know, piano gestures. And so I would kind of float somewhere between those worlds. But yeah. Hmm.
Do you ever have a moment where you're listening to a piece, whether it's classical or not, whether it's like Joni Mitchell or not, and suddenly you're reminded of a Joni Mitchell song? You're like, those 2 seconds of music sound just like that moment in that Joni Mitchell song.
Oh, totally. And that happens in my own music too, which is weird. It's like, oh yeah, I got that from Joni, or, you know, maybe that other person got that from Joni. But yeah, Joni is just such a deep part of my musical DNA. You know, and I think that's true for all of us, where we have these figures in our history who are so critical. And sometimes it becomes hard to tell, like, which part of our identity was there from the beginning of time, and which came from this love of their music. And I mean, I guess that's true for every composer. We're sort of a big mashup of all the stuff that we love. And what's interesting about each composer is the way that those influences reconfigure themselves in each individual. But yeah, for sure. All the time I hear little things there and there, and I'm like, oh, that's from the river, or that's from this piece or that song. Yeah.
She's a great artist, Joni Mitchell. Night Ride Home is one of my favorite records. Oh my gosh. I got that album because of the drummer.
Oh,
Vinny Caliuta was on that record.
Oh,
and he's a drummer that I would just follow around. And I listened to it, and then I really got to know it. And I was like, wow, what an amazing record. To this day, Cherokee Louise, I still can remember every line of that song.
Wow. Yeah. She's incredible and so imaginative. She just goes off on these flights of fancy. They're just, yeah.
Yeah. And the poetry of music from that time period was so profound. And I feel like that's something... I feel like that's something we're kind of missing now. We've lost some of that poetic, deep impulse.
Yeah.
We've become so interested in ourselves and how, in our image, that we are not, you know, it's like, it seems like a lot of music, the lyrics are very shallow and very, they don't dig that deep down into what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why. I know. I feel like it's the less famous singer-songwriters who are doing that work. But then it's like, how do they get themselves heard? You know, it's so hard to compete in this marketplace where everything is this just sort of ephemeral, quick, shallow, surface appeal kind of music. Yeah,
mm-hmm. It's true. Hey, let's switch gears here and talk about the first piece that I would like to play as part of the show. And we're going to go ahead now and listen to Unremembered Number 1 Prelude by our guest, composer Sarah Kirkland Snyder. The conductor is Edwin Outwater, and the vocalist is Shara Nova.
Thank you.
if you don't mind, I would like to read the lyrics to that piece so that the listeners know what was being sung about as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, sure.
So the lyrics for Prelude from Unremembered by Sarah Kirkland Snyder are: someone breathed into my ear, the vapor of the dead. It woke me up. I was asleep. It circled round my head. It all comes back inchoate. The meaning has no base. I never learned to love someone the way I did that place. So where did that come from? Did you write the lyrics?
No, so I did not. Actually, the lyrics were written by my friend, the poet and writer Nathaniel Bellows, who's a friend of mine that I'd known for many years since college. And he's a wonderful published writer, has some books with Norton, et cetera. But I have always really loved his writing because there's this lyrical aching quality to it. And he often does write in this kind of metered verse, but it reminds me of, I don't know, there's this, it's like Edgar Allan Poe, there's this gothic kind of quality that's mysterious and intriguing, but at the same time, it's very beautiful and rhapsodic, and it's often the visuals are often very, bucolic is the wrong word, but beautiful and descriptive and atmospheric. And anyway, he and I had worked together on a couple projects, and I was commissioned by this vocal group, Roomful of Teeth, to write some music for them. So I asked him to write me a few poems, and he wound up sending me about 35 poems that were all about his childhood, and specifically about, he lived on a farm in rural Massachusetts, and it was a big expansive piece of property where he would just get lost as a child and wander. And he said he usually played by himself. Most of his friends lived too far away. It was very rural. So he had this very active imagination, and he would go out into the woods and communicate with the animals and see ghosts and witches and talk to them and, you know, see dead bodies and all kinds of, you know, things that scare us when we're kids. I think that we see in movies or hear in books or Grimm's fairy tales, and then we take them into our imagination, and maybe they become even kind of a stand-in for things that we're dealing with in our real life. And so, I think this is something that I know I did as a kid, where I would take things I didn't understand that were like too grown up and adult, and I would sort of translate them into things that I understood that could make sense to me, like monsters. And so this series of poems was also about that phenomenon, where it's like how a child translates the world that they see around them into terms that they can understand. And then in turn, as we grow up, how those places where we experienced those kinds of memories can haunt us in a way and sort of have this psychic hold on us for the rest of our lives. So Nathaniel, for instance, with this particular part of Massachusetts, he now has this sort of complicated relationship to it where, you know, he still feels haunted by it in a way. He loves it, but he also dreads it. And so I thought that was a really interesting combination of emotions. And I wanted to write about that in particular, this sense of affection and dread and how they can kind of fuse together and almost like a Stockholm syndrome where we, you know, identify with our abuser or anyway, it was just this very rich, fertile ground, this series of poems that he sent me. And I thought, I want to turn this into a much larger song cycle. I don't just want to write three songs. I want to make this a whole world. You know, I think it helped that I know Nathaniel so well, and I knew a lot of the backstory to his life. And so I could sort of imagine a lot of emotional terrain that wasn't necessarily in the lyrics itself, but that I could sort of impart my own musical interpretation to. So anyway, it was just this, it felt like a Grimm's fairy tales world where I could dive into this big leather bound book and build a world. And that's something that I really love to do is build a large world.
That's really great. And how does the title Unremembered come into all of this?
Yeah, so that was a term that I think was in a, gosh, now I'm going to get in trouble. I'm not sure if it was Whitman or it was a poet that, I'm sure I'm wrong about that, but it was some other poet who had written about things that are unremembered, meaning like not forgotten, but that we have a complicated relationship to. Yeah, it's just, it's a piece about memory and childhood and things that are too hard for us to understand when we're kids. But I really wanted to get back into the way that we experience the world as children. So the piece is full of these big dramatic gestures and it's unabashedly emotional, very direct. I mean, the text lent itself to or inspired that to a large degree because, as I mentioned, it's all metered verse and it was all very, I think it was iambic tetrameter. And so, you know, that sort of lends itself to a kind of periodicity in the music that we associate with pop music, even though, you know, lots of composers like Schubert, et cetera, wrote with periodic phrasing. But getting back to the emotional train, like I wanted there to be moments where there's big, scary drums and, you know, large, almost like movie trailer studio booms. Like I wanted there to be big gestures. And so I worked for a really long time with the producer on the studio magic side of the recording. We did a lot with electronics and the processing and filters. And I really wanted to make sounds pop. I wasn't trying to be loyal to the classical sort of purist way of recording classical music, even though this was written for a classical ensemble, you know, bassoons and oboes and stuff like that and strings and harp. But I wanted it to have a more cinematic kind of quality to it, like so that you really feel like you're in this Technicolor world.
I think you accomplished that.
Let's go ahead and move on to the next piece we're going to listen to from this collection of songs. Unremembered, this is The Barn.
Thank you.
Whoa, super cool.
Thanks.
That is great. I love that. I know I'm not supposed to gush, but that is really, really great.
Oh, thank you.
Just, I had flashbacks of Genesis and Peter Gabriel and prog rock.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I get the Peter. I mean, he also sounds like Peter Gabriel.
He does sound like Peter. That was the big trigger.
Yeah, no, but for sure. I mean, I was a big Peter Gabriel fan, still am. So he's a big part of my DNA as well. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. And there's a lot to like in Peter Gabriel.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, for sure.
Well, that was fantastic. You know, this particular movement has a lot of dark aspects to it. Certainly in the imagery that you described earlier, but also in the context of the music, it sounded really aggressive, almost like hyperventilating.
Yeah.
Can you describe a little bit about what's happening in this
piece?
Yeah,
so that's cool that you said hyperventilating, because I was really going for that. So in this is a poem, a story about when he was young and he went to get something in his family's barn, and he saw in his mind the barn was on fire, and there was like a man walking out whose head was on fire. There was a little girl in like a tulle dress sitting in front on the stairs, and there were these ghosts in various stages of array dealing with this fire, and it really freaked him out as a kid. And so I wanted to capture that sense of terror that you feel as a child, where you just don't understand what's going on. I should say that when I wrote this music, my kids were that age. So I have two kids who are now 15 and 13. But when I wrote this, I guess that was almost like 10 years ago, they were like 5 and 3. And, you know, everything is so big and dramatic. And just wanting to get that sense of larger than life experience of the world, that was very present for me, just living my, you know, seeing the world through their eyes at that point in time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I wanted to get that sense of anxiety, that heart racing anxiety.
Well, and the choice of using a singer who's kind of more on the pop side, I think I've been thinking about this for a long time as a classically trained singer. With contemporary composition, a lot of contemporary music jumps around quite a bit, and the intervals are very dissonant sometimes. And as a classical singer, sometimes I think, or as the audience listening to classical singers singing that kind of music, it can get kind of grating. Why would the same composition sound be emotionally powerful with a voice that is not singing operatically, but great on you when the voice is singing in operatic style? You know, you referred to, you know, earlier, some of your music is controversial because it kind of traverses these lines between pop and classical. And sometimes the purists, you're not making any of the purists happy because you're not following their rules.
Right.
But maybe you're actually doing something that needs to be done, because to actually, you know, people complain about contemporary music not reaching you emotionally. And maybe it's not the music. Maybe it's the way it's performed. And maybe it's the singer. Maybe it's the style of the rendering.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. These are such interesting questions that I have wrestled with for such a long time. And a lot of my peers who I think are wrestle with this too. I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for bel canto singing. It was, you know, invented for, you know, singing opera to these large halls and to, you know, without microphones, but, you know, we don't need to sing that way all the time. And in fact, the problem with that kind of singing is that you usually are involving a vibrato that's more of a tremolo than a vibrato. It's more like a vacillation between two pitches. So I think for me, why it gets grating is because it's harmonically confusing oftentimes with the instrumental, you know, context that it's in. It'll confuse you harmonically, or it'll take away from the beauty of a simple melody because you're listening to this tremolo and the pitch confusion. There's that, but I think there's also this, you know, classical music, classical singing, it's about aspiring to a technical paradigm, right? You're trying to sing the most technically, in the most technically bel canto kind of way. You're aspiring to a certain style of singing more than you are necessarily aspiring to sharing something emotional. Now, of course, the best bel canto singers will do both, But I think what we often get is more of the aspiration to the technical without the emotional component. So, you know, with pop singers, what you're getting is character, right? It's often flawed singing. It's often like, it'll be a little scratchy or out of tune or whatever, but those flaws are what make it feel relatable and human and personal. Like we're hearing something that is related first person, their own experience. And that's why I chose to have these pop singers sing this music. I mean, Shara and David and Padma, who are singing on Unremembered, they all have classical training, but they also have lives as pop singer songwriters. And they do their own music and they sing with microphones and they can sort of live in these different disparate musical worlds aesthetically, but they know how to retain that sense of character and storytelling. And I think that's what's really compelling about pop singing is that feeling that we're hearing someone tell their own story. And so that's what I was after with Unremembered. You know, this is something that I still wrestle with now because I'm writing an opera that is conceived for bel canto, although I'm asking for lighter vibrato singers, but I want it to be singable for, you know, by all kinds of singers for the hopefully all time. So you have to write for the technical paradigm. But at the same time, you know, I worry about that. Like I do worry that I will lose something emotionally by, I don't know, the intimacy of a different kind of singing is very compelling to me. And there is something about a lot of modern opera that leaves me cold emotionally. So I'm struggling right now with how to find the balance between those. But did I answer your question?
Yeah, actually, I you answered it really well. And I think I didn't ask it as well as I think you got my drift. but you know what, I would say if you are wrestling with it from the audience point of view, I mean, and from my own personal point of view as a singer, I think we need composers who will challenge the paradigm. And we need to be given permission as singers and audience members to enjoy and experience a classical music that suits our time and not isn't just always reaching back to that bel canto time. And I'm a bel canto singer. I love the old bel canto Italian art songs and arias and things. And but they were made for their time. They were made for the Italian language. That style of singing it suits the Italian language perfectly because and even if you hear Italian pop songs, they still sound like they're singing bel canto sometimes because that's just the language.
Yeah. And also the harmony of the time, you know, triadic tonal harmony can support that kind of tonal variation that you get in vibrato because you always sort of know what harmony you're in. But when you're dealing with non-triadic harmony and then putting that kind of bel canto vibrato on top of it, that's what can get quite harmonically confusing, I think, and a little bit grating on some people's ears, but maybe that's just.
But at the same, you know, you listen to a jazz singer, you listen to a pop singer, and they're using the same intervals. And it works, and it doesn't grate on you. It gets to you. It gets to you emotionally. Yeah. And I think you should just follow your instincts on that and push the classical world to understand that this music requires some kind of different paradigm, a paradigm shift with singing style. And it would be refreshing as a singer to have the opportunity to sing in a different way and learn how to sing this music and reach people. Because I think that's something that we as classical musicians working today struggle with because, you know, if reaching people emotionally and being relevant is difficult as in the classical world. And maybe it's because we're still reaching back and we're not connecting because we're still too tied to our old paradigm.
Yeah. Yeah. So. I'm glad you're saying all this. It's very inspiring for me at this point in my
life. You're inspiring.
This is a great conversation, you guys. This is awesome. I love it. This is very informative and very philosophical. It's fantastic.
Oh, cool. Yeah, great.
Let's switch gears and we're going to stay on vocal music.
Sure.
I'm sure that a lot of listeners already are familiar with your piece, The Mass for the Endangered. which is a beautiful title, by the way. And we're going to listen to the Kyrie here in just a moment. What's that?
Sorry, I was just going to say, again, that's Nathaniel Bellows, the same writer of Unremembered. He did the libretto for Mass for the Endangered. It's his title. Yeah.
Well, the Kyrie is striking. You know, it's the opening movement of the piece, and it's the first thing we hear, and it is absolutely striking. I want to go ahead and take a listen to this, and then we have some questions, things we can uncover about the piece. Thank you. That was Kyrie from Mass for the Endangered by composer Sarah Kirkland Snyder. It was commissioned by Trinity Wall Street as part of their Mass Reimaginings. The text written by Nathaniel Bellows. It was performed and recorded by Galakantis and Gabriel Crouch from the album Mass for the Endangered, co-released by Nonesuch Records and New Amsterdam Records. So I have a question about that piece. Mm-hmm. It's for SATB choir and 12 instruments, and I find that very unique, very specific amount of instruments. Why 12?
So I can't take credit for that decision. That was given to me by Trinity Wall Street, and I think it just had to do with the kind of consort of players that they typically played with. But I loved it because it had both, you know, it had the intimacy of a small chamber setting, but you could also go bigger and make it feel more like an orchestra.
Is it going to become something like the Pierre Lunaire ensemble? You know, it's like, it's the kind of ensemble that just gets written for again and again and again. It almost actually reminds me of the Copland piece of Appalachian Spring. The original orchestration was for 13 instruments.
Oh, I didn't realize that. That's so interesting. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then it was reorchestrated for a much larger.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I love this instrumentation. I hope it'll take off.
How does this mass differ for you from a more religious text like you would see with Mozart or Beethoven?
That's such a great question because, you know, when they gave us this assignment, Trinity said, you can write about anything you want, have any text you want. However, they wanted two of the movements, the Gloria and the Sanctus Benedictus, to remain in the original Latin so that they could potentially use them in their church services. And so that presented an interesting challenge because that text is all about Jesus, right? And honoring the glory of Jesus and the one and only Father and all of that. And I had to find a way because this music, you know, was supposed to be about endangered animals and about the planet and the environment and, you know, not only animal suffering, but human suffering. And I was like, how do I rethink this, you know, Latin text about Jesus and keep it in touch with the text that Nathaniel had written? So I did two things. In the case of the Gloria, music is all about the glory of God. And I was thinking, okay, I'm going to rethink this as, or I guess there was one line that's like, they kept saying, you are the only one, you are the one Father, the only truth, you know, something or other. And I started thinking about, you are the one Bengal tiger, you are the one red fox, you are the one polar bear, you are the one of each kind of species that's endangered and dying out. And so that enabled me to sort of rethink it in this very, approach the text differently emotionally and stay engaged with the thematic matter of the mass at large. And then in the Sanctus Benedictus, it was a similar thing where the text was about the celebrating, you know, the glory of Jesus. And so I thought about, okay, let's celebrate the glory of biodiversity and let's celebrate how incredible all the flora and fauna and the different species and how sad it is that we're losing so many. And that enabled me again to just connect with a similar kind of emotion about, you know, celebration and joy and reflection and sentiment, but not worry too much about the religious undertones or overtones. And, you know, we sort of did that in a larger sense with every movement of the mass. We wanted to keep the general architecture, the order of the movements and what they tended to represent in the traditional mass, but instead substitute different meanings in the text. So, mm-hmm. It was sort of just, you know, really about replacing Jesus and God with Mother Nature and the planet and animals. And it was very easy for me to access emotion about all of that because it's something that I care deeply about, that both Nathaniel and I care deeply about. So it was very easy for us to decide to write on this. And I don't know. In fact, I often ask myself, like, why was it so, I got so inspired and I wrote this music so quickly compared to other music that I write. And I think it's because I just felt this really intense emotional connection to the topic and the cause. And I think that when we feel that kind of emotional charge, it really helps you be creative. So anyway, yeah.
Well, I think he's still achieved these. I mean, it feels sacred. It feels, I mean, it feels connected to that old tradition of the Mass, you know, and in a way, I think that it's not so far to translate that, you know, the feelings of those religiosity and directing that towards God. It's not so far to direct it towards the creation, being, you know, the outward expression of, you know, God's creativity, right? So
nail on the head. Yeah. Which makes sense for me because that is sort of my religion. I mean, that's how I think of, that's where I get my sense of awe and wonder. It's from music and from nature. And so it's very easy for me to think of nature and the planet. That's my house of worship. And yeah, to apply that same sort of grandeur of feeling and deep spiritual connection. Yeah.
This piece, I've listened to other movements of this piece too. And we talk about endangered animals or animals that have gone extinct recently. But I think about the animals that have gone extinct thousands of years ago, the Ice Age, mm-hmm. you know, and again, it almost sounds biblical to say what was, what is, and what has come to be. And I think about the endangered animals as well. There have always been endangered animals. There are always animals yes. going extinct. It's sad
in
to
a
me.
Way. Dead. Yeah, it is. And in a way, it's when you think about it that way, it starts to feel like, well, maybe this is the natural course of things. But as humans, we're altering it a bit too quickly. You know,
as humans, we have an opportunity to do something about it as well.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Now, did they choose the topic? You chose the topic.
Well, they said we could write, we could have any movements that we wanted as long as we had a Gloria and a Sanctus Benedictus.
But it was a Mass, right? That was yes. what you were commissioned to write.
Yes.
And I just think it's really fascinating that, you know, the Mass is like, what was it for? It was, you know, you did a Requiem and that was, it was for, performed for someone who had passed away. But in every Requiem, there's always this sense of a cycle and a circle and like that death and life are part of a natural cycle. And there's, you know, the Gloria is part of that, you know, mystery of life and death and loss and rebirth. And because when I listen to your Requiem, it doesn't leave me feeling hopeless.
Yeah. Yeah. That was really important to me because I think there is hope and there has to be hope. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know how else do we continue living if we don't have hope, you know, especially in the case of these animals in certain, with certain species, there are things we could really do to turn things around pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, with certain species there aren't, but yeah, you know, there's every reason I think to have hope that things can get better for our planet. It's going to take a lot of work and a lot of time and money, but we certainly can turn things around. And I think, I don't know, I say this as, it's funny because I can never tell if I'm an optimist or a pessimist. I'm like a depressive optimist, but I genuinely believe in hope. I think in all things in life, I think otherwise, I lose a sense of what reason there is to live, you know? So I think, and even my music often does go quite dark, but I like to have there, in order for it to still feel human to me, there needs to be an element of warmth and hope. So that usually finds its way into whatever I'm writing, no matter how dark it gets.
Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful too. Mm-hmm. Beauty helps, temper the darkness a little bit.
So earlier you had mentioned that you were working on an opera. And I wanted to revisit mm-hmm. that now and to give you the floor here to talk about your future projects.
Sure. So, yeah, I'm working on this opera that I've been working on for years, on and off. It's about Hildegard von Bingen, the 12th century composer, polymath, theologian. She just did so much in her time. And she was recently canonized as a saint, but, you know, of course, we know her best as a composer. But the reason we know her best as a composer was because of her visions. And that's what really intrigued me you know, how she got the permission from the Pope as a woman in the 1100s to write down her visions. She was the first woman in the Catholic Church to write anything, you know, to claim herself a prophet of God and be given the right to write down what she said God told her. You know, usually women who claimed such things were, you know, dubbed all kinds of crazy names and kicked out of the church. And so I wanted to know how she pulled this off, what she did. And I've just been studying her, reading about her for years and thinking about how I would pursue an opera about her. And I've now written, I'm on my third draft of the opera. I'm writing the libretto myself, which is an ill-advised endeavor. It's really scary. And it was something that I put off doing for a really long time. I tried to work with a couple other writers, but they just weren't as engaged with the material as I was, or I had too specific a story I wanted to tell. And they were like, you should just write it yourself. And so I'm taking some elements of truth from her story and I'm injecting some of my own elements. I'm playing with her visions a bit. And I don't know, it's a real adventure. I'm having a lot of fun with it, but it's the scariest thing I've ever done by far. And we'll see how it all shakes out.
Is there a premiere in view? Is there a date set?
Yeah, I'm not allowed to say where it's supposed to premiere, but it's supposed to premiere in the fall of 25. So we're doing some workshops. Like I've got a workshop in Cincinnati in the fall and then another one in Chicago in the spring. And I just did a workshop at Princeton with it. So hopefully by the time this thing gets to stage, I'll be relatively happy with it. But it's been a real struggle. It's really finding the balance, you know, trying to tell a story in music. It's a lot different than just meditating on an emotion. You've got to take care of making sure the plot is clear without sort of sinking into really boring recitative. Like I want my music to be melodic at all times and to be singable and song-like, but you don't want everything to be song-like because then it all feels the same. And so I'm just struggling a lot to make this an opera of the kind that I would really feel moved by and want to listen to. It's really hard. It's much harder than I thought it would be, you know, 10 years ago. But that said, I'm really enjoying it. So
I'm very excited for when it comes out.
Well, we're looking forward to hearing it.
Thank you. I mean, my hat is off to all the modern opera composers out there because it's really a tough genre. And I think so many of us are drawn to it for that reason because it's like feels like the ultimate challenge, you know, telling a story in music and making it moving and exciting and dramatic and compelling. And it's hard. And with the bel canto voices again, you know, and non-tonal language. And if we want non-tonal language, you know, it's tricky. Mm-hmm. So
sounds exciting though. Yeah. Sounds really, really exciting.
Well, I know you'll figure it out because I think you just have the right instincts. But one thing I'm appreciating very much about you is how you care about the emotional impact of your music on the audience.
Yes.
You don't have this attitude that, oh, well, it's their job to educate themselves and, you know, approach this intellectually when that's just unnatural. Music has never been meant to be, you know, from the very beginning. It's a tool of communication emotionally and socially. And, you know, it's about our nature in some way.
Yes. I couldn't agree more. That's why I got into music, as I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation. You know, it's about moving, communicating and moving a listener, hopefully, making them feel something, making myself feel something, you know. And we can only sort of, you know, be our own ideal listener, right? But I think, I respond the most to music that moves me emotionally. Like I can get really excited about the intellectual, you know, pyrogenics of a piece, but ultimately it needs to move me emotionally. And sometimes intellectual pyrogenics on their own can move you emotionally, but it's a different kind of thing. And for me, you know, I just feel like my strengths lie more with trying to communicate. And so for me, that's about atmosphere and emotion and storytelling, narrative. I that's why I got into this. That's the music that I am most excited when I listen to, and that's the kind of music that I want to write. So for better or for worse, you know, it's not always easy. It certainly was not an easy path when I was in graduate school. And, you know, attending certain summer programs and all of that, you know, it hasn't been in vogue to write in this way, you know. Maybe recently things are changing and loosening up. But when I was younger and coming of age, it was, you know, there was European modernism held sway, and you know, the values, even if you're not writing European modernism, this idea of putting your heart on the line and being unabashed and saying something directly was just not something that was really done. You know, it was so almost by some, you know, in some circles considered in bad taste to do that. And yet when you look back at the history of music for thousands of years, that's what composers were doing. They were putting their hearts on the line and saying something very directly and communicatively. And so I think it's a product of our time, you know, this different prioritization of values, you know, the past 100 years, 150 years. But, you know, history has these ups and downs. And I think ultimately as composers, we have to please ourselves and write what we want to hear. And, you know, we're all here for such a short amount of time. It just doesn't make sense to use your time pursuing anything that doesn't really excite you and move you. So anyway, that's what I try to tell myself. That's what I tell my students.
That is great and an incredible way to end this show. Sarah, I want to thank you so much for being on the show with us today. It has been such a pleasure getting to know you and talk to you.
Oh, likewise. This has been a really fun conversation. You guys had great, great questions. Just like you said, Anna, you're awesome. Really great.
Right? Oh, I told you.
Don't stay up like that. I had to like.
It was awesome. You guys are the dynamic duo. You both ask great questions and you're really fun to talk to. And this was one of the best podcast conversations I've done. I really enjoyed it.
Well, so thanks. We could do another sometime if you want. Maybe after the opera premieres or something, we could do another one.
Sure. That would be awesome. Yeah. You guys are great. Thank you so much. And thanks for your stylistic open-mindedness. It's really refreshing. It's awesome.
Well, we are just, you know, we're searching too. We're trying to find, you know, we have the same questions you do, and we think about the same kinds of problems. And I just think there need to be more conversations, open conversations about, you know, what we're doing here. What are we doing? Yeah. You know, and.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Totally. The why of it all. Yeah. Very important.
You have been listening to the music of composer Sarah Kirkland Snyder on the Composer Studio. If you would like to learn more about Sarah and her music, you can visit her website at sarahkirklandsnyder.com. That's Snyder with an I. A lot of passion and work goes into making the Composer Studio. This show would not be possible without the support of our listeners. Thank you. And if you would like to support our show, please visit our website at composersstudio.net. Before we go, we would like to leave you with this little nugget about the creative spirit. I sing my sorrow and I paint my joy. Sorrow is easy to express and yet so hard to tell. Joni Mitchell.